Hey guys, what is up? My name is Cliff. Welcome to episode number 14 of Being Famous Podcast. Also, welcome to 2021. I hope everyone around the world is off to a great new year. And as always, I hope everyone is also doing well and staying safe. If it's your first time checking out the podcast, much love and greatly appreciated. I suggest you go back and listen to previous episodes because I don't know, man, you know, I actually think they're pretty good and I think you will enjoy them. If you're a regular listener, I appreciate the continued support. To get all the latest podcast news, follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Being Famous Podcast. To listen to previous episodes and to learn more about this podcast, check out my webpage, beingfamouspodcast.com. If you're out there listening in the podcast world, specifically on Apple Podcasts, please leave me a rating and a comment. That would be greatly appreciated. Now, let's get on with episode number 14. Their song, Whoomp, There It Is, went all the way to number one in 1993 on the Billboard Hot R&B charts and went all the way to number two on the Billboard Hot 100, where it remained for seven straight weeks, only to be held off from the number one position by UB40's Can't Help Falling in Love and Mariah Carey's Dream Lover. The record has been certified four times platinum. That's four times platinum, guys. That is very, very, very impressive. Let's welcome to the podcast, calling in from Atlanta, Georgia, founding member of the duo tag team. His name is DC Glenn, also known as the Brain Supreme. That's such a great name. DC, what is up, brother? Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yo, party people. What's up, Cliff? Man, I really appreciate you having me on the Being Famous podcast.
You know how we do.
What's up, man? You ready?
I'm ready, man.
Let's do this.
Let's go.
Whoop.
There it is. That's awesome, man. That is absolutely fantastic. Thanks again, man, for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. DC, let's jump right into it. Let's get to it, man. Tell me, how did Tag Team come to be, and how did you guys get your start?
We're from Denver, Colorado. We grew up together, me and Steve. And we met in our junior year in high school. And Steve and them had a band called The Business. And I wanted to be a part of that band so bad because I seen they would play in the quad at lunchtime sometimes. And I just really wanted to be in the band because I thought I could sing and I could do something. And that's how me and Steve met. We all met, you know, me and a couple other, we all met because I had transferred from another school in 11th grade. So that's how I met all my friends there. And I also worked in the permission slip office, right? And down the way from the permission slip office was the choir room. And I used to be beautiful music coming from that room every day. And it was like a siren song. And I would go down, I would stand by the door and I'd just listen, right? And they'd just be singing their ass off. And I just like to listen. And one day, Miss Davis caught me. And her name was Miss Davis. She was the choir director. She's like, come in here, boy. And I went in and she was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm just listening. I just like the music. She was like, all right, you know how to sing? I was like, no, I never thought about it. She was like, come see me after I finish, when you get out for your next class. And I went and seen her. And she made me audition right on the spot. And I made the choir. And ever since then, I was, you know, I was singing all over the city. We went on all kind of field trips to sing. And Steve and them, after beating them in the head, they finally let me in the band. And then, you know, I soon became, you know, just the coordinator of the band. I got us shows. I bought drumsticks, drum skins. Made sure we practiced, made sure everybody was on time. We practiced in my garage in Park Hill in Denver. And we had a lot of support from the neighbors because we played good music. So it was just fun back then. And then we would play when I come home from college, you know, during the summer. But at the same time, while I was in college, I met freshman year cat named Johnny Z.
Sorry, man, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so what year would this have been?
82, 83, 83, 84.
Gotcha.
So junior year, 82, 83.
Okay.
That's when Michael Jackson, Off the Wall came out, 82, 83. And then our senior year, I'll never forget it, we were over Big Mike's house. And we were just all sitting there smoking a little weed. We had just finished playing a football game. And Friday Night Videos had a world premiere. And it was Michael Jackson Thriller.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the most incredible thing anybody had ever seen at that time. And that just even fueled us even more, because that was the height and the apex of Michael Jackson at that time. Because when Thriller came out, it was over, right?
Yep.
And that was an influence. So fast forward, I graduated from high school. I moved to California, went to school at Sac State.
Okay.
And I'm a freshman in the dorms, and guy named Johnny Z, he's, you know, down about three or four doors, heavy metal dude. And me and him became friends. And I taught him how to DJ. And he taught me about metal music, how to play the guitar a little bit. And we just had an appreciation for music. And Johnny Z, for people who don't know, there was a song a year before Whoop There It Is came out called Back to the Hotel by In Too Deep. And Johnny Z produced that, along with JT and the other brother that was in the group, right? And we were, you know, we all went to school together. So I was down in Vallejo with E-40 and Hammer and Too Short and everybody before I even really figured out that I wanted to be into music, because it was all in the Bay Area. And I was at school at Sac, so I was always in the Bay. So, you know, I'm a DJ in college. I sucked at first, but I got better. And then sophomore year, Johnny Z got a four-track. And once he got a four-track, he didn't know how to use it. And I was like, give it to me. I'll figure it out. Figured out how to use a four-track. And probably in the spring of 1985. No, I was 86. Spring of 86, I learned how to make songs. Because my boy Cornell had an 808, but he wouldn't let me use it. So I had to take the four-track over to Cornell's house. Cornell was like, you can stay here all day and make beats if you want. So I made like 10 beats.
Nice.
On an 808, classic 808 machine.
Heck yeah.
And then I just took the four track back home. And for the next maybe month, I just wrote lyrics, put stuff over the songs, played little whack ass keyboard stuff, played a little hand flute I had, hit some pots and pans, whatever sound I can make, did some scratching on everything, whatever I could do. I made, just filled that song up with so much stuff, and it became a song. And then that was the realization that, wait a minute, I know how to make songs. So then everybody was inspired by me. I sent it to Steve because he was still living in Denver. And, you know, he thought I was like, what is this, devil worship? It just blew him away, because we had to go to the studio to make songs, right? When I would come back on break, we would go to the studio, spend all our money on studio. We'd make five or six songs, and then we'd be done. But this was, I could do a studio in my, I could make a song in my house.
Cool story. You mentioned Steve. That would be Steve Gibson, also known as Steve Roland, the other half of Tag Team. DC, what type of music were you making?
Just hip hop. Because I was influenced by hip hop, because as a DJ, I ordered my records from 12-inch Dance Records in Washington, D.C. 12-inch Dance Records was one of the biggest record stores on the East Coast. Then I was ordering from Bobby Jimmy's, which was the biggest store in the West Coast in San Francisco. So every Friday I get a shipment of records, and it'll be the newest thing out, period. So I remember I would throw parties in the dining commons. I would have to move like maybe 100 tables, 500 chairs. And I did it all by myself just so I could throw a party. And every Friday, everybody got to hear the newest hip hop. And I'm talking about the week that Run DMC dropped Peter Piper and My Adidas. I'm talking about Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Girls of the World Ain't Nothing But Trouble. I'm talking about EPMD, So What You Saying, and You Gots to Chill. I'm talking about MC Shan. I'm talking about all these East Coast records, right? But then I started getting the West Coast records, you know, and then it's like Boys in the Hood, you know what I mean? The infamous first record, Easy, and then where are they all on that cover drinking 40s? That was historic for us because we were on the West Coast. So now the West Coast is catching up. So it's West Coast, it's East Coast, and I'm playing all these records and I'm mixing, making mixtapes the whole nine. So I'm influenced by all of this. Planet Rock, all the stuff from New York, all the stuff from LA. Because if you do Planet Rock, you got to do Egyptian Lover on the West Side, right? And at the same time, when I would go home to Denver, I started hearing some stuff from the South. Started hearing Luke, Throw That D. Started hearing MC Shady, Gotta Be Tough, 86, 87.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
So fast forward, I'm well-established DJ, DJing in the clubs in Sacramento, DJing all the fraternity parties, DJing all the festivals, and making music. Now Steve got a four-track. We just making songs back and forth, just sending each other back and forth tapes, making songs. At this time, every time I just go to class just to write lyrics, writing lyrics in class and very popular, and I'm doing it. And the one record that blew me away was a Tone Loc Wild thing that came out my senior year, and it was just like, what the hell is that? I mean, Z and them were on the roof suntan, and we were up there listening to it. It was like, that is a bad record. That's one of the records that influenced me. And that was my senior year. I wrapped everything up. That Christmas, I went to Atlanta to visit Steve because he went to the Art Institute. He had moved to Atlanta and started going to the Art Institute. I think this was 88. I went down there and had such a great time, came back, called my parents, said, after graduation, I'm moving down to Atlanta. I don't care. I'll figure it out. And I moved down to Atlanta and had a job at CNN, but stumbled upon Magic City. Magic City is the one of the greatest adult entertainment clubs in the world. And the DJ sucked. I mean, really sucked. And I was like, ooh, I can get a job now DJing and still do CNN. And the security dude was like, well, Magic's right there. And I was like, hey, man, you need a DJ? And he's like, come see me Monday. So I went and seen him Monday. I said, I don't need no DJ, but I need a cook. I said, all right, I cook too because I chef. So I'm chefing too. And I might have cooked the order of chicken wings and a salad. And DJ Andre was like, hey, man, I got to go run some errands. Why don't you go up there and DJ for me? Just thinking that I was just some old DJ, right? And back then, you never let another DJ on your wheels of steel because he will take your shit.
Right.
Period.
There you go.
And that's what happened. And I got on the wheels of steel and the girls heard me. I was a different voice from somewhere else. I was from California in the South. And I made them more money. And we partied the rest of the day. And we have a monthly meeting at the club where everybody has to come. And it was that weekend. And that Sunday, all the girls stood up and said, we want him. And I was the head DJ. And the first night I worked there, I probably made like $600. $600 in a strip club. I was like, CNN can wait for a little while. And then curse me. I was there for 30 more years. Or just DJing in the club. But, you know, I couldn't really make a living off of DJing the clubs in California. But in Atlanta, I had a strip club and a club and made more than enough money.
Another great story. DC, you've said quite a bit, man. I want to circle back around to something that you mentioned earlier, just because I've had two guys on this show who have talked about the importance of it. The two guys that I'm talking about are Kid Sensation and Stevie B. I've had both of those guys on this podcast. And DC, both of them have talked about, and you mentioned it earlier, talked about how important the 808 was to them back in the day.
Yeah, because that was the time. See, they were all in the Bay. They all used to come up to a club on the south side of Sacramento and perform. Stevie B, Trinity, all of them, right? I used to see them all the time. And they were hot back then, but nobody really knew. Like, Shannon was the hottest artist back then, as far as freestyle goes, right? Shannon, then once Mantronic started putting out people, it had an influence, right? But it was kind of, you had House here, and you had Planet Rock and up-tempo music here, and freestyle was in between because it was a little bit lower in BPMs. It was like 118 to 122, 123. But the stuff, Tone Loc, was like 126, 28. You know what I mean? All that stuff. Planet Rock is 124 to 125. So it was just a little bit slower, but and it was just a different type of music. But it used to hit because it was the Bay Area, right? In the Bay Area, Filipinos, Hispanics, Latinos, that was that music of the time. Plus, you know, Black folks, a little bit of everybody. It was a mixing pot of people that love freestyle music. And, you know, it's ironic because we tour with those guys now. You know what I mean? We tour with Stevie B and Company B and just all those old artists, and we're real good friends with all of them, you know? So it has definitely been an interesting full circle journey as far as tag team goes, because I used to party with these people back in the day. And we didn't even know each other, but we partied together.
That's really cool. And really cool that you're friends with a lot of those guys today. And yeah, to your point, DC, freestyle music was huge in the Bay Area. That would be San Francisco. Also, Company B, you mentioned them. Company B had a pretty big song back in 1987 with the song Fascinated. DC, being a DJ back in the day, what was your take on freestyle music? And as a DJ, were you spinning at that time freestyle music?
Back then, I probably could only get away with playing maybe three or four of those type of records because my crowd didn't like that type of stuff. We were more on the Egypt, right? Egypt, Dr. Dre, Emergency, what is a DJ if he can't scratch, Jamie Jupiter, all those records like that because I was in California. So that's what everybody was making. And it was always, California was fighting desperately for respect as far as is in the hip hop game. Because I remember it would be West Coast DJs against East Coast DJs at it was this conference in New York City. All the time, the West Coast DJs would win, but it was in New York. So New York wasn't about to let a West Coast DJ win a contest in New York. So it just never happened. But I mean, DJ Aladdin and all those DJ Arabian Prince, all them DJs, they used to kill it. They were the best cutters and scratchers, period. And they just went to New York and it wasn't happening in New York because you got DJ Cheese, you know what I'm saying? You got all those just real old school locked in DJs who, you know, that's who they was going to give it to. And, but that it was hard to play freestyle for me back then because of my crowd, not because I didn't like it. It's just because of where I DJ.
Yeah, I gotcha. DC, you mentioned it earlier. And when you mentioned it, I was like, man, we got to talk about that. So I made sure to make note of it. I want to circle back around to it now. And that is that you lived right down the hall from Johnny Z in college.
Yeah.
Like you said, Johnny Z, part of In Too Deep had a pretty big song back in the day in the early 90s with their song Back to the Hotel, which has now become just a classic hip hop track.
Yeah.
That is a really cool story, man. And I never knew that about you.
Yeah.
Where is In Too Deep today?
Johnny Z's he lives in LA and he is the owner of a meat distributor. And he's been making a lot of money doing that. And then since the pandemic, he just can't. He's really rich now because they made a run on meat, right? And he does organic beef and a lot of stuff like that. So pretty much every store just bought him out. He couldn't even fulfill all his orders. So he's doing very well. The guys, JT and, those dudes are still, I guess they still perform every now and then. I haven't talked to them in a long time. Cause me and Z, we're still best friends to this day.
You know, really?
I mean, that's still one of my best friends in life. Yeah. You know, and it's ironic cause he's really the only person from my college days that I still communicate with often.
That's really cool, man. And good to hear that he, you know, went on to be successful. DC, that would have been 90, In Too Deep, Back to the Hotel, 90, 91, 92?
Yeah, it was. I got out in 89 and they came out in 92. I came out in 93.
Very cool. And as you were talking, DC, I'm doing a little bit of research on the side while you're talking. And DC, over 41 million views of Back to the Hotel on YouTube, man.
Yeah, it's funny because they shot the video the day of the Rodney King riots.
Wow, crazy.
We shot the video. And that was the first time I met E-40. Because E-40 and all his clan were in the In Too Deep video.
I didn't know that. Were you in it?
Yeah, I was in the video.
Really?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. You look at that video. I'm in that video. I flew out there and everything. I flew out. I remember I had sex with this girl I always wanted to have in the morning. And took a shower at our house and left and got on a plane, went to L.A. And then when I got off the plane, the riots were blowing up. They had people on the Bay Bridge. It was just crazy. It was like everybody was nervous. It was just crazy. We went to Chevy's to eat. And then woke up the next day. And that night we did the video. And I had a ball. And the guy who did it, his name is Michael Lucero. He passed away a couple years later, but he did Genuine's Pony.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, it's just all these little historical facts, you know, that I've lived, I'm sure trigger other people when they hear me talk like this because I was there for all of it. You know what I mean? Like I really was in enthralled with all of it, every city that I've ever lived in. So
yeah, man. And you mentioned historical facts, and that's the one thing that I love about this podcast. Just as you have all kinds of stories and all kinds of things that you've lived through, everybody that I've had on the podcast, I mean, they all have stories like yours, man, to where they know this person or this happened to them or whatever it may be. It's just story after story. And every time I talk to somebody, I learn something new. It's really cool. DC, where was that video shot? Was it shot in LA or was it shot in San Francisco?
No, I was shot in Vallejo.
Yep. Okay. Gotcha.
Shot a hotel, like a Motel 8, Hotel 6, whatever in Vallejo. And it was easy.
Very cool. Vallejo, basically a suburb of San Francisco. So DC, moving forward, you end up in Atlanta. You mentioned it earlier. You land the head DJ gig at Magic City, and you're there roughly for around 30 years, right?
Not there. I started 89, and my last club was Strokers. I stopped in 2015. So that is 25.
Okay.
Because I remember when I first came down here, me and a girl came down here with us, Tracy. We went and seen Spike Lee Do the Right Thing, 1989, the summer. It was the day after I moved here and got here from, because we drove cross country. And we all lived in one apartment. And then once I got in Magic City, it took me about a week to get my own apartment. And then I was here, you know, and I was terrified. I was like, what am I going to do? How am I going to live? It was a serious leap of faith. And I didn't give a damn. I knew my destiny lied in Atlanta, Georgia.
Very cool. The ATL. DC, I'm assuming that while you have this gig going on at Magic City, you're also... I guess still producing music, still writing music, still DJing on the side. Were you continuing to do that along the way?
Yeah.
Okay.
That never stopped.
Gotcha.
Matter of fact, probably the first 2 weeks I was here, I was in a contest at this club. It was a slushy bar, right? Called Fat Tuesday.
Oh yeah.
Like in New Orleans, they have Fat Tuesday with all the drinks, and they're all just like slushy drinks.
Yep.
And it was me. It was like a round robin contest, and I performed. And the last round, I performed against ABC, another Brat Bad creation.
Oh, wow.
And they were little kids. I'm talking about 5 to 9, 5 to 10. And I clearly beat them, but they were so cute, and they were all dressed together that they had to let the kids win. So that was like my first big show in Atlanta. And we would perform all the time in Atlanta. You know what I mean? We're just putting in work.
Sure.
And, you know, but the thing is, we were doing hip hop and, you know, you're in the South now. They like certain hip hop, but you're in the South. You know, the first bass record I heard when I got down here was a record called Roll It Up. It was so popular. And it was just like, wow, everybody's just really rocking to this record. And I would go to the clubs, you know, that was the first year. That's when Dion got signed. Me and Dion was always together. Dion Sanders and everybody used to come to the club, right? Like even that's when Tiny Lister was getting big. He just passed away, but I got pictures of him and us in the club. Like everybody came to the club, to Magic City, everybody. And whenever you came to Atlanta, you came to Magic City. So I knew everybody.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's when Bobby Brown moved down. I moved here when Bobby Brown moved here. I moved here when L.A. Reid and Babyface moved here. We all moved here at the same time, dang near the same day.
Crazy.
So I knew all them. And, you know, L.A., you know, we all knew each other because it was like they all came to the club. And then, you know, Outkast would come to the club. All these cats that were kids would be coming to the club. And I knew them before they were even famous because they just came to the club and bought mixtapes and, you know, ask me questions, and it was just cool. We just was all friends. I was very popular because I had Magic City, then Madge opened Club Michaels, which was a dance club, and then that changed everything. That was like, okay, now I got a club and a strip club, so I'm really making money now. And I did that while I was making music, and you know, you get in a little rut for a while because you're just living and having a good time, being around 100 women a night. I was just having fun, man. I was living.
Yeah, man. I could only imagine that was probably a pretty good time in your life, hanging out with L.A. Reid and Bobby Brown and Deion Sanders and You know, you got some money coming in. That's, man, I'm sure that was an absolute fantastic time. And I'm sure you have some fantastic stories to share about that. But moving right along, DC, very cool story. You mentioned Another Bad Creation. Another Bad Creation had success with their song Aisha, also their song Playground. And you mentioned one of the first bass songs that you heard was Roll It Up. DC, I am familiar with that song. That song was pretty popular back in the day when I was in high school. And DC, that would be Success and Effect.
Success and Effect, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, that was my favorite record, right? You know, other than Shy D, you know, Gotta Be Tough. And those are the records that I was like, man, you know, for you, you know, then Kilo came along. He had a hit record. You know, Do You Hear What I Hear? And I'm playing all these records because everybody brings me every record first.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm playing all this vinyl. And it never really dawned upon me that, hey, dude, you need to figure out how to make some up-tempo stuff. What are you doing? But it did in like 91. And, you know, me and Steve had a conversation. I was like, dude, if we ever going to get out of here and be artists, we got to make this booty shake stuff, dude. And he's like, man, I don't know how to make that stuff, man. It's like, you ain't got to make that stuff. Just make it how you would make it. And just think Planet Rock and Egyptian Lover.
Yeah, man, there you go. Not a bad combination. Afrika Bambaataa and Egyptian Lover. DC, you mentioned it. Booty shaking music. What was your take back then, I guess, on that type of music? I mean, it was pretty prevalent. It was out there. I mean, you had groups like Gucci Crew, Clay D, of course, Two Live Crew, Poison Clan. What was your take on some of those groups back in the day?
You know, Poison Clan, that's JT Money. That's our boy. Love that dude. So I always been playing him because he would travel and he would always come up to Magic City. And I see him in Magic City. You know, I see all of them. They all, anybody that came up, Clay D, a lot of them cats. You know what I mean? Even when I went down to Miami on the first year of Womp, they all knew who I was because they would all come up to Atlanta. So we all kind of knew each other. And that really, I think that really helped me in the long run because people knew who I was before I even made a record. So when I made a record, it was like, that's cool. He made that record. Wow. I didn't even know he did that. I thought he was just DJing in Magic City. So that's what, you know, it just gave me a certain level of juice to have been at a club that, you know, so prestigious and still, you know, come out with a record. Like nobody had ever done that. And no record had been mainstream like that. You know, Two Live Crew was nationwide, but every radio station wasn't playing Two Live Crew. They had resistance on all fronts. So basically their resistance and their bad press was their publicity. That's what made them famous. But for us, we had a record that went everywhere. One of the first records that went everywhere. Like Tone Loc went everywhere. Mix-A-Lot went everywhere. It's all the same. Think about it. Baby Got Back, just because he's from Seattle don't mean that's not bass. It could be misconstrued as bass. But it was just another record, right? It's just, they're just records. Think about it. Tone Loc. Think about Young MC. You know what I'm saying? Think of the way that beat drops. That's the essence of hip hop because Planet Rock started it. Kraftwerk started it. Those electronica records in the 80s, you know, late 70s, early 80s started the whole thing. And then Planet Rock set the whole B-boy thing off. That's when everybody started breaking. That's when everybody started scratching. And then once everybody, you know, DJing, scratching and breaking came together, then people started making songs with records. So then it came from, you know, went from 128 back down to hip hop to, you know, the 95s and, you know, between 95 and 105 BPMs per minute. And then it stayed there in New York. But everywhere else, down south, West Coast, we were still doing the up-tempo stuff. And then Chicago comes on the scene with house. Now you got Chicago. Chicago is huge for house, but that's regional. But then it filters up to New York. And then all of that becomes mainstream. So, I mean, there's so many nuances to how things happened back then that, you know, you just have to kind of follow the footsteps of everybody who did it. You know what I mean? And I was there because I was playing all those records. I was always a DJ who played all kind of records because I went to every city, you know, especially when the internet came about. I would go and I would find the records in every city and download them. I find I was hot in Houston, in every state, because Atlanta, everybody used to visit Atlanta. So if I have a record from a guy who's in Texas and he's coming, he's spending money in the club, And I play something he never thought he would even hear in Atlanta. And it's from Texas. He goes back and tells the dude that made the record in Texas, who's just a local cat, man, they playing your record in Atlanta. Like, I provided so much hope for cats across the country, because I would play their records before they even knew that they would even be stars. They were just hood stars. But in every city, there's a hood star, and the radio station will play their records in the mix show. And if it hits in the mix show, it will get in rotation. It might only be on 5 to 6 times a day, but it's in rotation, and then it charts. Then I see that in a chart. I pull it down. Now I got that record. Then I can judge for myself, dang, this is kind of cool. And then I put that in the Texas folder, or I put it in the New York folder, or I put it in the LA folder, in the Bay Area folder, or in the Chicago folder, in the Midwest folder. And that's how you effectively DJ for a melting pot city that Atlanta had become.
Very cool. Absolutely love it. And I appreciate the explanation, man. I know myself, I'm sure the listeners as well, just learned something. We got a little bit of a history of hip hop right there from the Brain Supreme. Very cool, man. Thank you very much for that. So DC, let's get right to it. How did Whoomp, There It Is come to be?
So I was telling you about the conversation I had with Steve that we had to make something up tempo.
Right.
And I've got, where's that damn book? Hold on just a sec.
Yeah, man. No worries. Go find your book. Do what you got to do.
You're going to like this.
Cool, man. I'm excited to see what you got.
People can't see me, but you can.
Yeah, exactly. So for the listeners who are wondering, I can see DC. DC can see me, but it doesn't record the video. So the app that I use is just for conversational purposes. There's video, but it doesn't record. Now that we got that out of the way, what do you got, man?
These are all my rhyme books, right?
Wow.
These books, these are my manuals. Going back to 1984. And always, I had tons of songs. I don't even know which one Whoomp is in. But when we decided to do that, Steve made a beat. I kind of already had Whoomp, There It Is written. And I was like, ooh, I'm going to use this one for that beat. And it was that simple.
Well, there you have it. Podcast is over. Really, man? That simple?
That simple. That I could go to my books, pick a song that I've already had written, and then we recorded. And that's how it happened.
All right, cool.
There was no magic formula. There was no, hey, we need to do it like this. There was none of that. It was just a song I had in one of my rhyme books. And we made a song. And it hit. And I'm sure that's what happens with everybody with a hit record. You ask everybody that has a hit record, and they will tell you, we hoped that it would hit, but you didn't know. You never can know, right? You never can know. And the genesis of Whoomp, There It is it was a party saying back in the day. So whenever a crowd get riled up, people start saying, Whoomp, There It Is. And it was everywhere. You know what I mean? Just in the Southeast, though. And just made a song about it. And that was it.
Hey, man, there you go. Pretty simple. I like it. So you and Steve wrote and produced it?
Wrote and produced it.
Okay.
Steve, for me, me and Steve wrote, produced it. And we recorded it in August of 1992. And took it to Magic City that night, played it on a cassette tape. And to this day, that is the biggest response on any record I have ever played in my DJ career. At least 10 people came to the DJ booth like, what the hell is that? What is that? You got that on tape yet? You got that on mixtape? Nah, man, I just did this, dog. That's you? Man, y'all got one there, player. That's all I heard.
That's great, man. That is awesome. Very, very cool. How did that make you feel?
I was happy. But you know, I had heard that before with other songs, right? Not to that effect, but, you know, people are always kind of responsive because it's cool to have the DJ make his own songs, right? So you looking at it like, that's cool. That's a good one right there. I like that, dude. But when people ran up thinking, what the hell is that? And I want it, I knew I had something. But at the same time, just a young kid and I don't know no better. I'm just playing it, having fun. Because all the girls like it. And then the girls want to give me some booty because they think I'm doing some things, right?
Yeah, I hear you, man. Actually, no, I don't, because I've never been in that position. But anyways, that's great, man. So DC, you kind of mentioned it earlier. You guys, like you said, you really don't know if you have a hit. So I'm guessing that when you and Steve are recording this, you guys are probably just thinking, right? By your own logic and by what you told me, that it's just another song, right? And that you guys are completely clueless that you have a hit on your hands, right?
Nah, it's just another record.
Yeah.
We would do tranches of records at a time. So if we're going to buy studio time, we're going to do 6-7 records at a time. Because you might get stuck on one record. Well, let's leave this record alone, go to this record. So you go to different records, right? Until you complete them all. And that's kind of how it was. But Won't There It Is, we did do that by itself. But at the same time, we didn't look at each other. And it was like, let me go to the club and see what this sound like. And it was on cassette. And it was instant. And then I played it for about a month. And then I stopped playing it because I was making other records. It was always more records to play. And we just sat for a while. We sat on it for a while. I actually forgot about it.
Pretty wild. DC, does the version, the original version that you and Steve recorded, does that sound anything like what we hear as the final product and what we hear on the radio today?
Hell no. Nah. Completely different record.
Yeah, sure.
The one that we cut that day, Magic City Girls was in it. It was a Magic City version. The last verse was a Magic City version. And it was all about Magic City, where I worked. That's really what Won't There It Is was about, a song where I worked at. And then the last verse was an ode to the girls at the club. And then, me and Steve were talking about this today. He was like, they didn't bring the energy that we needed as far as a party track. So we recorded it again. And we wrote a different last verse because I knew we weren't going to be able to get away with it just having a Magic City verse. We needed something cleaner. And we re-recorded the song first, though. But first, I had played it again. This girl was like, why don't you play Won't There It Is? This is like January, early February. And I was like, shh, I'll play it for you. And I played it again. And the same thing happened. So this is 3 months later. I played the same thing happened. And all the record reps used to come and drop me off vinyl. So I was friends with everybody. A cat named Alan Cole, he worked at Columbia Records. He was in there, heard it. He was like, what is that? I was like, that's my new record. He was like, give it to me so I can send it to New York. And he sent it to New York. And then I started going to meetings to try to get deals with all the majors. But they were bullshitting, you know. Well, you know, it's a great record, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Right. Who were some of those labels that you went to?
Columbia, A&M, Epic, Mercury, Warner Brothers. They're like, it's just a great record. We hear it. But, you know, let's wait. Let's wait a few months and we'll see what happens. It's just like, dude, this record's a hit now. Why are you going to wait 3-4 months? Because they're thinking artist development. How are we going to develop the artists? Do you have any other records? You know, going through the same thing. Like, dude, you got a hit record right now. We'll make it up. We got tons of songs. You know what I'm saying? Like, what are you talking about? But that's the game. I don't hate the game. That's what it was. And I got frustrated. And you got to realize I'm making tons of money at Magic City. So money's not really a thing.
Sure.
But it was like, I was about to give up. I was like, man, forget this. I just, you know, it is what it is. Then Lisa McCall, Mercury Records, said, hey, you need to call Al Bell. He used to own Stax Records back in the day. Mavis Staples, Isaac Hayes, you know, Otis Redding. I was like, really? Like, yeah, he did. He put out Deuce last year, Daisy Dukes. And I was like, yeah, I played the hell out of that record. Well, you know, he kind of knows how to, that thing did good national. He kind of knows how to work a national record. I was like, bet. She got me his number. And I called him. I was like, Mr. Bell, it's DC Glenn, tag team. Got a record down here, man. You need to hear. It's a hit record. Please call me back. About a week passed. Call me back. And, you know, he was like, so what's up? I was like, hey, man, I got a record. I'm a DJ at the hottest club in this city in the Southeast. Everybody knows the record. It's a big record. We got one. He's like, all right, let's do it. I was like, what? You haven't even heard the record, Mr. Bell. Like, brother, I don't have to hear the record. I hear it in your spirit. Let's agree to agree. Next day I called Steve and said, we got a record deal, dog. He's like, really? Like, yep, we got a record deal. And this was about 3 weeks later, gave my 2 weeks in Magic City, and I was out, Freak Nick 93. A month and a half later, we're platinum.
Wow, man, that happened really fast.
It was that fast.
Really cool, man. That's pretty amazing. So DC, how does this work? Because you already told me earlier that the original version that you and Steve recorded is completely different from what we hear on the radio today. So I guess at some point in time, you guys, even before signing a deal, knew that at some point you were probably going to have to re-record it and I guess make it, you know, radio friendly, if you will. So how does that process work? And what exactly happens with the label once they get their hands on it?
We knew this before we even got with Al Bell.
Yeah, right.
So we knew we had to redo the record, right?
Yep.
And when we redid the record, we did it at Kayla Studios. And Kayla Studios happens to be owned by Ichiban Records. So we cut Whoomp There It Is. We re-redid Whoomp There It Is at Kayla Studios, right? And one of the cats from Slave came in.
Nice.
Because he knew George, the engineer. Because George is like, man, you guys got one with this one. George is like, this is a good record. I mix a lot of records. This is a good record, DC. And Steve, and I was like, okay. And Slave came in. You know, Steve, that was one of his favorite groups growing up. And, you know, the guy from Slave was like, man, this is a good record. Everybody came in that studio that day, like, this is a good record. This is a great record. And I think it was maybe a couple weeks later, Steve had to go back and put some finishing touches on it. And George was like, hey, man, we just recorded another Whoomp There It Is record. It's by 95 South, and they're on Ichiban. And George and them were worried. He was like, man, they're going to think that we gave them this record and that, you know, that 95 South stole it from them, right? And, you know, we was like, nah, we know better. We had this record for a long time. We told you what the story was. We came and remixed it, right? So that's when we first found out about 95 South. So that's probably early March, late February, early March. And that's why it was such a sense of urgency to kind of get our record out. That's kind of why we signed a bad contract, because it was like, man, we'll deal with this shit later. We got to get this record out. And we got the record out. And my last week at Magic City, Freaknik, they recorded their video in Atlanta that weekend. So that's how that, then we were off to the races. And we were ahead of them every step of the way. We started doing promos immediately. We were in Detroit, we were in LA, we're in Southeast Montgomery, we're all over the place. And we never looked back. And that's how it happened, man. And I have never really, you know, understood. You know, I understand, but I don't understand, because it's just a coincidence that everybody had the same record at the same time. It's happened before in the history of music. So, but at this time, with such a big record, the media played it up as a battle, right? It was the easiest narrative to deal with. So every magazine article, a lot of them were about, well, who had it first, them or them? And so we would do interviews together. We did Arsenio together. But we did Arsenio together to raise money for the floods in the Midwest, because it flooded real bad that year. So I wasn't really tripping on that, right? Because I was already where I wanted to be, platinum artist, by the month of May, right? By the end of May, I'm a platinum artist. All my dreams, it came true. So I wasn't really worried about anything else. And never have worried about anything else to this day. So, I mean.
Yeah, man, I hear you.
I don't know if you want to ask more questions about that, but whatever you ask, I can show you paperwork. I can lay it out for you in detail.
No, you're good, man. I believe you. But you did mention a few things, DC, that I wanted to mention. You mentioned that Slave came into the studio. That is pretty cool, man. Slave, a pretty big 70s funk band back in the day. You also mentioned that you guys signed a bad deal. Unfortunately, that seems to be the norm in that industry, in the record industry. But yeah, man, 95 South's version was Whoot, There It Is, W-H-O-O-T, to where y'all's was Whoomp, There It Is, W-H-O-O-M-P.
Yeah, Whoot, There It Is. Yeah.
At that time, what did you and Steve think of 95 South's version?
Oh, we loved it, because it's bass. See, theirs is more bass, more of the, they're from Jacksonville, so they're from Florida. So it sounds like a bass record. But see, Whoomp, There It Is a bigger record. because Whoomp There It Is the genesis of hip hop. Whoomp There It Is Planet Rock and Egyptian Lover. Whoomp There It Is. And we had a record company who said, okay, this record is gaining steam. We're not going to fight with them for the Southeast. We're going to start LA, Seattle, Portland, Minnesota, and then we're going to close it in and we're going to cut them off in the Southeast. And that's what happened. Cut them off in the Southeast. We had already done everything by the time they did it. We had already done every major market by the time they did it. You know, when the Bulls won their third championship, it was 500,000 people in Grant Park chanting Whoomp There It Is, not Woot. You know what I mean? And I'm not being glib or anything. I'm just stating facts. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, for sure.
We were everywhere.
Yeah, and that's literally no exaggeration at all. You guys were absolutely everywhere. And for the people listening who don't know, back in 93, back in 94, the song was absolutely enormous. It was huge. Obviously, it became a catchphrase. Everybody was saying, Whoomp, there it is.
Yeah.
Sports arenas all around the country were playing that song. Yeah, man, it was absolutely huge. Also, DC, talking about 95 South, I think the difference lies here. You guys' version was much more radio friendly than what 95 South was, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, 95 South's version is a bass record. I lived in Tallahassee, Florida at the time back in 93, so I'm familiar with bass music. And because they're a bass record, I think they limited themselves on what they could do, to whereas yours is much more radio friendly and it's much more of a universal type sound.
But that's the whole point.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
the reason we still get to do shit today, because when There It Is, it's a perceived clean record. People sing that song every single day and know it word for word, and they don't even understand that it's about drinking, having sex, smoking, getting girls, having partying in a strip club in the Southeast. But because we didn't cuss, it could be anything that anybody wants it to be.
That's exactly right.
You see what I'm saying?
Of course.
That's the beauty of it, man. That's the beauty of it, dude. And,
yep.
You know, if we did a dirty record, I wouldn't be sitting here now on the precipice of a Geico commercial infiltrating the whole world for the next year. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't be able to go do shows all over the world still to this day if we weren't clean. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, DC, it could be anything that anybody wants it to be. That's exactly right, man. And that's why a lot of groups, a lot of bands, a lot of lyricists won't say what their lyrics mean, because they want the song to be about whatever the listener perceives it as. So I completely get where you're coming from in regards to that. But tell me this, man. How does it work? How does Whoomp There It Is blow up? Does Al Bell and the record label just start pushing it to radio stations? The radio stations start playing it,
yeah.
And boom, before you know it, you have a hit? Is that how it works?
Right. Okay, so you have who's going to play it on radio? So Al Bell's got all these old school, he has all these old school relationships. He could say, I got a record, play it. And the radio station be like, well, what you want to pay? And it's not about what you want to pay, but how much advertising you're going to spend on the station.
Wouldn't that be considered payola, DC?
Not really. It's like campaign finance. when you're running for office, there's several ways to get the money, but it's all a contribution. You know what I'm saying? It's not just me giving you money to do. It's not a quid pro quo, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It is, but it's not, right?
Right.
So you have consultants who are the liaison between the record company and the radio station. And they work out a deal to where the artist comes in and might do a show for their summer jam or what have you. And, you know, the radio station in return gets promotion out of it. Like I said, we started. Everybody was already playing ours in the South. And in the South, basically, we all helped each other, because there was three records. There were three Whoomp There It Is records in the Southeast at the same time.
Crazy.
Like, A-Town Players was big in Atlanta, right? It was A-Town Players, Tag Team, and 95 South. Even before then, Disco Rick had a Whoomp There It Is record. Then there was probably 10 more Whoomp There It Is records throughout that summer. But we were already gone. We were already in L.A., San Francisco. I remember it was in July. We went from San Diego to L.A., to San Francisco, to Reno, Nevada, came back down to Sacramento, and ended back in L.A. all in one day doing shows. We started at like 4 o'clock, and just ran the gauntlet all the way up the West Coast and came all the way back down. We finished about 5 in the morning.
Wow, that's crazy, man. That's how you do it, huh?
That's how you break records. It was set up like that.
Gotcha.
We would go to Jersey. We would go to New York, do Conan O'Brien, but then I would have shows set up in New Jersey, Delaware, all the surrounding places that were, you know, 30, 60 miles away.
Sure.
And we'd run the gauntlet. And now you've secured a region and you're hot. Not too many artists can say they, you know, went to Z100. Z100 is the number one radio station in the country in New York. There is nothing bigger. And we were there. So, I mean, every major market, we were there. Every small market, we worked. We put in work to promote that record. And the record kind of did, the record really did all the promotion itself, but they brilliantly promoted that record. And like I said, they were kind of confined to the Southeast. That's why a lot of people liked them in the Southeast more than they liked Tag Team, because they were bass artists down there. But I'll take it the way we had it, because we've been able to live a good life on one record for 26 years, even going through trials and tribulations. We've been able to maintain a nice lifestyle and be blessed. So I wouldn't change nothing.
Yeah, and good for you, man. DC, when you mentioned they, obviously you're circling back around to 95 South. But yeah, man, 26 years later off of one record, it's absolutely amazing. DC, do you know the first radio station in the country that played Whoomp There It Is?
Yeah, B103 in Atlanta. Brian Cameron used to play it as the bed when he would talk during station breaks. So you got the instrumental playing of Whoomp There It Is every 20 minutes. And everybody's like, what is that record? And they're like, people that knew the record would call the radio station and say, play Whoomp There It Is, man. You got to play that record. Why are you just playing the instrumental? And B103 did not play rap back then. And it forced them to play rap. We were the first record at B103 and to be in major rotation on a radio station that didn't play rap music. And that couldn't have happened unless it was clean.
No doubt.
Right?
Sure. Makes sense. So DC, the record comes out, it blows up, it's huge. I mean, you're all over the place, man. You're traveling the country. You're doing Arsenio Hall. You're doing Conan O'Brien. I'm sure you're being pulled left and right in every direction because everybody wants you. At that point in time, how much did life change for you?
Not much.
Wow. Interesting.
Because you know why?
Tell me.
Because I was raised by two beautiful, loving parents.
There you go.
And they kept me grounded. And because I worked at a club where everybody came, I used to watch how artists would act. And I vowed to never be that way. You know, I used to watch artists come in and act an asshole and treat people like shit, right? And it made me feel bad. And I was like, you know what? I will never, ever be like that. And I never was. We never walked around with security. We never had entourages. We would always just slide in and slide out. And everybody knew who we were. And it was like, hey, what's up, dude? You know, boom. You know, everybody knew me from Magic City. So it was like, I knew everybody. And we were in and out everywhere. And I never changed. And because I didn't change, it allowed me to fold back into society when things calmed back down. You know, we were still doing shows, but because I always act the same, I'm still going to the same places I always went. I'm still seeing the same people I always see. And then nothing ever changed. So, I mean, you know, it never changed for me. It's not going to change now. It's not going to ever change. If I become a big movie star, I'm still going to be me. I'm not going to be some egotistical jackass who, you know, walks up to every woman like, you know who I am? Like, I used to watch dudes do. I learned this is the one thing strip clubs provided me with as a man, is the ability to learn and understand what not to do. And I have a lifetime of experience of learning what not to do, and I don't do it. And it's made my life a lot better. It's made my life I feel so blessed because I worked at that place. It prepared me for so much in life.
Yeah, I can only imagine what that lifestyle is like, man.
I mean, I'm around pimps, hoes, killers, hustlers, thieves.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I'm around the worst elements of life. But all those elements taught me what not to do. And it just made my life a whole lot easier, man.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And good for you, man. DC, circling back around real quick to the record. Back in the day, as the record is blowing up, is there now a tour set in place for you guys to tour the country?
Yeah, Budweiser Superfest.
Okay, nice. Who was on that tour?
We're on tour with Shy, Belle Biv DeVoe, SWV, MC Light, Queen Latifah, and who else? There's one more. Oh, Jade.
Nice.
Yep, it was us, then Jade would come on, then SWV, and then either MC Light or Queen Latifah. Queen didn't come with us all the time, but Light was there a lot of the time. And then it would be Silk, Shy, and BBD.
There you go, man. Some heavy hitters from back in the day, man. Back in the mid 90s.
Yep. And we would start it off, and you know, we were pissed off that we had to open, but you gotta pay your dues. But it ended up working out because nobody bought the energy we bought. Right. I remember one show we were late and they put us up. They had to put us up like right before. I think we went up right after like Silk. And man, it was Buffalo, New York. And we were doing our entire show, but they was like, hurry up, hurry up. And they were about to pull us off. But then we got to Woomp. And when I said party people, every other artist came from out of their dressing rooms and watched that arena. Because it was that loud that they didn't know what was going on out there. It was that loud. And it was at the peak. It was in the summer. It was just all the perfect time. And that today is one of our best arena shows. And then one of the best show of us that we've done all time is Hippodrome, Leicester Square, London, England. With CC Peniston.
Nice. CC Peniston, of course, had a pretty big hit back in the day with Finally. So DC, that was going to lead me to my next question. Obviously, you just said London, England. So clearly, you guys ended up touring the world.
Yep.
What was that experience like?
I mean, just being able to go see some place different experiences. The best, though, was Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. We performed in Amazon jungle. I never thought on my wildest years that I'd be performing in the middle of the Amazon jungle in a soccer stadium on a mountain.
That's really cool, man. DC, as you probably well know, man, some beautiful women in Brazil, DC.
Most beautiful in the world.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with you on that, man.
Yep, most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. I fell in love.
Oh, man, here we go.
With a woman that was charging me for the first couple days to have fun with her.
Uh-oh.
And then we just end up having a good time the rest of the way, and she didn't charge me no more. And that was my woman for a whole month. And if I could have, I would have bought her back and I would have married her. That's how beautiful she was. She was that beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, man. You don't have to convince me. I believe you.
She's probably one of the most beautiful women that I have ever had the pleasure of just being with in my life. I mean, I'm talking about her skin was gold. I mean, gold.
I hear you, man.
With nothing on it. No gold tainted.
Right.
You know, sunscreen. I'm talking about gold. Her hair was gold. Her eyes were hazel, but she had a black woman's body.
Oh, man.
Right. And it was ugly. It was ugly. But, you know, that was one of the best experiences I ever had in my life. Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Oh, man, that's great, dude. DC, where else did you guys go around the world?
Germany, London, where else? That's kind of, we did all over Europe, and then we did Rio de Janeiro, Canada, and that's it. We never got to Asia. We never got to Australia. We never got to South America. And we were going to do Chile. We're going to do Chile and Colombia. And this is back in the early 90s. This is like right after Pablo Escobar gets killed, right?
Yeah, gotcha.
So that didn't that was like, we don't need to do that. But that's how big, you know, I mean, people wanted to bring us to Asia, but when you do internet back then, when you did international, you had to get the money up front. And if they didn't want to do the money up front, then you know they weren't serious. people who wanted you in there wanted up front. Europe was just, we had to do all Europe because we were doing a promo. So we did TV shows. We did everything there. So, I mean, it was, we had fun. We had fun, man.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Had to be a blast. And what's really cool, man, is that you guys got, you know, life experiences, man, that most people in life will never get. And that's just really cool and good for you guys. DC, let me ask you this, man. At the time of the record, as the record was having success, as it was blowing up, as you guys were touring the world, did you ever stop and think to yourself that, you know, and this is no slight towards you at all, man, but that you have a shelf life and that this record is only going to last for so long? And that at some point in time, you're probably going to need to come out with something else. And if you do come out with something else, it might need to be or probably needs to be bigger than Whoomp. But in order for it to be bigger than Whoomp, that's going to be very, very difficult because Whoomp is so big as it is. Did any of those things ever cross your mind?
Hell no. Nobody thinks that.
Yeah. And why not?
Because you think you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. And you think every record that you touch is going to be a hit record. And you have no worries in the world. And all you got to do is just make the songs and they're going to hit. You got a Whoomp, there it is, every song you do. But it don't work like that.
Yeah, no, man, you're right. And unfortunately, you guys weren't able to follow up Whoomp. DC, looking back on it, musically, is there anything that you would do differently? I mean, you guys were hip-hop artists, obviously. Your song crossed over and had great success as a crossover hit. Would you have done anything, looking back on it now, different musically?
If I had anything to change different about the music, I would have just been banging out up-tempo records left and right. Think about it, man. Everybody had put out an up-tempo record after us had success, from Britney Spears to Black Eyed Peas to, I mean, think about it. You know what I'm saying? Andre 3000's biggest record is an up-tempo record, 150 BPMs per minute. Think about it. All the biggest records in the history are big records. Our up-tempo records, you know? And it just changes slightly into different forms of music. But, you know, you don't know that when you're in it. You're happy you're a rock star and you're balling. And then, you know, it's all good. It just happens. So, and then it fades. And then you come to the realization. And then you're like, what the hell am I going to do? And then you go back to your regular life.
Right. So what happens, man? I mean, you ride the success of Whoomp, There It Is, for quite a while. You end up having issues with your record label, like most artists typically do, it seems. In a nutshell, man, and I know it can get confusing with the record labels and, you know, the lawsuits and all that sort of stuff, but just give me an idea. What do you do?
Label went bankrupt. So once the label goes bankrupt, there's nothing I can do. But then in bankruptcy, another record label buys the catalog for Bellmark, and then them buying the catalog for Bellmark, they think that catalog is supposed to have Whoomp, There It Is in it, the publishing. It has Whoomp, There It Is, the mechanical part of it, but not the publishing. So they just take it. So then it becomes a journey of Al Bell and Bellmark trying to get the rights back to Whoomp, There It Is. So he kind of sells, you know, he kind of enlists one of the heavyweights that really go in and can get people their money. And, you know, both sides were wanting us to sign stuff to be part of it. And we were like, nah, I'm not signing anything ever with nobody. And we just let them fight each other, fight it for 10 years and bloody themselves up. And, you know, fast forward to 2012, it was motion after motion after motion after motion. 2012, Bellmark finally got their day in court and they won the rights back. Then it was another 6 and 7 years of appeals and, you know, bankruptcies, and well, now we got to go bankrupt because you were bankrupt first. Now we're bankrupt. Now we're trying to get all your assets. So it's just a brutal fight, and we're in the middle because, you know, we can help either side get a judgment, but we stayed neutral. And, you know, toward the end, the second record company, number two, it's like, well, if we go down, you guys are going down, and we're taking all your shit. And then that's when we had to fight. And that's when I had to spend everything I had just to keep what I had and end up winning a lot more than I had. But, you know, it's like with war. You can go to war, but you're going to come back. You might be missing a foot, you know, a pinky. Can't hear. I got shot out. You know, you're still living, but you've been damaged. And, you know, that was 2017. But once we got that resolved, then everything opened up. Then we started really, we were doing shows, but just like NBA halftime shows, little shows here and there. Once that was over and I knew there was no way that they could, you know, come in and put a stopgap on us or just be real jerks about things, then it was like, okay, let's go get the money. And I had been talking to people the whole time and they were like, gosh, you need to put together a show. And that's the first tour we did when that happened was the freestyle tour.
Yeah, there you go.
And just isn't that ironic? Freestyle tour, and we went all across the West Coast, up and down the West Coast, and we did a lot of shows, made a lot of money, and we've just been developing our shows ever since. And now we're poised to do about 40 shows this year, but the pandemic. But you know, that's cool because you foresee these things coming, and I'm always like, well, what if you don't get no shows? It's always in the back of your mind because you got, but boom, there it is. It's so big. And people want to hear it. We're going to get shows. But what are you going to do if they want an hour show? Well, I took comedy classes so I could learn how to be a comedian. But I'm not being a comedian telling jokes to the crowd. As a comedian, I'm using that comedy as segues to songs they've never heard before. So I have an introduction to a song they never heard before, so it's acceptable to them for a good 2 or 3 minutes till I can get to the next segue.
Right. There you go.
You see what I'm saying? You piece it together.
Yeah.
And you're telling jokes, but you're not telling jokes. You're just playing with the crowd.
So if anybody ever checks out a tag team show, there's going to be a little bit of comedy involved as well. I like it. DC, man, that stuff with the record label is crazy, man. It's nuts. It's insane. You explained what you did as far as the record label stuff goes, but what did you do personally once Woomp started to fade? What did you do on a personal level?
Oh, man. Magic City had burnt down and they built it back. And then I just fell right back in.
So you went back to Magic City.
Yep. Everybody thought I bought the club. So it was perfect. And then Canadians came down and bought a big club in Buckhead, like a 5,000, you know, like a supper club. It used to be a supper club. It was built to compete with Club 57, Studio 57 in New York, but in Atlanta. So it held on a Saturday night, it would hold 4,000 people. And they came down here because the Olympics were here in 96. And they were like, we're going to buy, we're going to make a lot of money. And it was a dud. And there, you know, all the owners of the club had backed out and they just left Wayne McComb. And Wayne, you know, I had been DJing. I did a Tuesday night there. I lucked up and finally got in. I've been trying to get in that club for so long. And I went to Wayne. I said, dude, you turn this to a black club, you'll make millions. And he did it. And he turned it into what to this day is Atlanta's greatest club, Atlanta Live. And I was the head DJ at Atlanta Live. And you're talking about 5,000 people on a Saturday night all dressed up. You know, you had to be good to DJ there. And I was good. And I was making show money DJing. So I didn't skip a beat. That lasted till 2000. I worked at another club because they wanted that land. So Atlanta Live's last night was like 1999. And then I was DJing in Buckhead, this club called Otto's. If you remember, Otto's last night. That was the last night I DJed in a club was the night of the Super Bowl, LA Rams, Tennessee Titans, that Ray Lewis had gotten all that trouble. And that was my last night at the club. And that night was just bananas. I'll never forget it. And after that, it was just the strip clubs because the strip clubs was just making more money than anybody. And it was just easy. I've been doing it for so long. It was easy. I worked 2 days a week. But so that freed me up for other things. I became a licensed commodities broker. So I wanted to get into the financial thing, you know, put together a hedge fund. Like I had big aspirations to do something different. And the music, you know, all the while still keeping an eye on the lawsuits and everything. You know, I wasn't we weren't really doing any shows and we were just living. And, you know, you kind of fade and you think that's okay, it's about it. Then every now and then we get a call. Hey, can you come do a VH1 show? Can you come do a I Love the 90s show? Can you come do a class reunion show? Can you do a, you know, whatever? And we, you know, we spent the 2000s having the show sprinkled about. And then around 2009, that's when the NBA came calling. And we started doing shows in arenas. And we pretty much done every NBA team a couple times. Then we started doing NFL shows. And then we started doing tours again. So it just, you develop your show. And if you got a good show, people, you know, we do the casinos. We do everything, man.
It's really cool, man. And really amazing that, you know, all of that off of one song. So DC, obviously not a huge catalog of music, man, but I mean, whatever, man. I mean, you did it.
Exactly. And we were at the top of the world for 3 years.
Exactly.
Some people, they only top of the world for 2 weeks.
Shoot. If that.
If that.
No doubt, man.
They never get to the top of the world. They never get past damn Alaska. We were on the North Pole, man, for 3 years, man. 3 years. And then now there's another ascension. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you, man. It's pretty amazing, and it's a great story. DC, looking back on it, man, how fun was it all, man?
It was fun. You know what I said? This was my goal. I told my father this. I said, Dad, I just want to be in history books. I'm in history books. I mean, I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records. You know what I'm saying?
Didn't know that. What are you in the Guinness Book for?
For having the most selling single in the history of rap music at the time, as far as physical albums being sold. See, now it's muddy because you got downloads and views and listens and, you know, like, think about it. If I was saying this on the podcast the other night, if you counted every time a kid rewound his cassette on Woomp There It Is, how many listens would that be? How many plays would that be? Pushing loop on the CD, how many plays would that be, right? With Woomp There It Is now, on the street corner with a boombox, how many rewinds would that be? On vinyl, how many plays would that be? It would be, if you equate that to views and spin, you know, spins or plays, it's a lot, dude.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot. Even if you're conservative and you say it's 10 times, you know, quadruple platinum, that's 40 million. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, man, that's a staggering number. DC, did Woomp make you a millionaire many times over?
One time over. Because, I mean, it's a single, right? It was a single, and we couldn't get the publishing money on it because we didn't have administration to the publishing. We own 50%, but the record company had administration, so now they pulled the strings, and they say, well, we got to recoup all the money we spent on you. So that's how they get the young kids, and then they don't ever have to pay them again. They always can come up with an excuse. Kids don't know how to do forensic financial audits on a record company, right?
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? Any forensic financial audit would have showed that we could have got our money, but that would have took the amount of money that we probably would have got to win it.
Yeah. How much money would you say that Woomp There It Is has generated over the years?
Woomp There It Is generated $24 million.
Wow.
And we probably got two of that, which is good because think about how the point system is. You know what I mean? 9 cents on every record. That's, you know, record companies know what they're doing. It ain't like land.
Right.
Well, you really own it or you really own half of it. Once you give away those rights, this is the perfect analogy. I equate it to what Dave Chappelle just said. Everybody thought Dave Chappelle was the richest man in the world when he had the Chappelle Show. And he wasn't, because he sold the rights to the Chappelle Show.
Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't know that.
Well, he signed the rights away to the Chappelle Show. And they could do anything. He was a young dude. And they could do anything they wanted to do with it. And when he's like, I don't want to do this no more, they're like, okay, it's cool. But we still own the rights to it. Now they have the rights to 2 seasons of the most classic comedy, that sketch comedy that's ever been made. And every time he sees it, it's got to kill him because that was his child. And they took his child away. So that's how Woomp There It is for us. Not really, though. I don't give a shit. I don't care. Because look where I'm at. Look what I get to do. I don't work. You know what I mean? I get a royalty check. You know what I mean? It's not what we should get, but I still get a decent amount of money to live off of. So we got We got paid. I can't lie and say we didn't get paid and we didn't get nothing. We got paid. But, you know, that money goes by fast when you're trying to sue a record company. So when you're trying to sue a record company and you balling and you got 20 women and, you know, you're flying all over the world, that money kind of goes quick.
Yeah, man. I wouldn't know about it, but those women add up. That's for sure. That's funny, man. DC, realistically, man, you guys got $2 million off of it, you said. Realistically, what do you think you guys should have gotten that would have been fair?
If it made $24 million, I think we probably should have got probably, you want to say half, but that's not realistic. So a quarter. So like five and some change. That would have been nice. But I don't really trip on not getting it because we would have spent it. Just would have spent it on more extravagant bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, everybody goes through this, man. Nobody teaches kids from the city how to, if you get money, if you get that money, you're supposed to hold on to it and you're supposed to flip it into other money. Nobody teaches us that. So nobody taught me that. But my father did. My parents did give me quality rules on money. You know, you live below your means and you spend less than you earn.
Wise words from your dad, but I guess when you're young and you have a hit single, that those rules kind of go out the window. DC, we're getting a little long here, man. I'm going to let you go in just a minute, man. But staying on kind of the record label type stuff, first class seats, right? Those meals, all of that sort of stuff, right? That all comes back to you guys paying for that, right? I mean, that's not the record label that's picking up that tab.
Exactly. So we're paying for all them limos and all them first class seats and all them hotel suites and all that crap. And we're looking at it there, you know, and they're saying, well, this is your per diem, but it's not our per diem. There's no such thing as per diem because in my experience, every time we've gotten a per diem from somebody, that comes out of our pocket. Here's $50 so you guys can eat. No, that comes out of our pocket. Well, I thought Disney was paying for that. Nope. Disney charged the record company and the record company charged you.
Yeah, man, it's pretty interesting. And the label's got it figured out. They know what they're doing. And they're not going to get screwed.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, of course.
They know exactly what they're doing. And I don't blame the record company, not one bit. I don't blame Al Bell. I don't blame nobody. I take full responsibility about what happened. Full responsibility. Because I did have lawyers. We did have representation. And we still got. So I don't fault anybody. It was up to me to be on my shit, whether I knew what to do or not. It still was my responsibility. And, you know, when you own up to your responsibility, things become a lot, you know, it doesn't hurt as bad because you're being a man about it. Take my licks, keep it moving. You know, as long as I'm breathing, I'm on offense and I'm pushing. I don't care. It's going down. Whatever I do, I'm pushing. I'm aggressive, you know? If I get tired, I just be tired. I don't care. I'm pushing.
Yeah, man, got to watch those record labels, man. They can. They sound like they can be pretty shifty. DC, sometimes this is looked down upon. I'm not sure why. And obviously, when I ask this question, I mean no disrespect by it at all. But what is it like to be, or better yet, do you enjoy being a one-hit wonder?
I do. I love it. Like, I'm about to do a whole blog post on why I love being... Like, you can call me a one-hit wonder because I guarantee you there are a million artists out there who would love to have my record.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me I'm wrong.
Nope, you're right.
You can have 10 albums and never have... You can have 10 albums and not have a hit record, and I guarantee you that artist would love to have my one hit, right? And it's not like, you know, one hit is a negative connotation because it's like, you had one hit and you couldn't make nothing else because you suck. No. I tell people have one hits because one, the hit is bigger than anything they'll ever make. And you don't know what anybody's situation is in. They might have signed a record, messed up record deal and said it wasn't worth it to keep trying to make records for a record company who's going to keep screwing me. That's why people are one hit wonders. Or you fell out with the record company, or you spent all your money, or you did something stupid, or you got hooked on drugs. There's all kinds of reasons. Nobody's a one hit wonder because they suck. You know what I'm saying? There's no such thing. You love their song for a reason, and they put that song together. Now, maybe the other stuff wasn't as good, but That doesn't mean that doesn't that should not have a negative connotation. That's why I do all kind of SEO for one hit wonder, because I want the world to know where if you just got to look at it like this. If I am going to be a one hit wonder, what record do I want to have to be a one hit wonder on?
Yep, sure.
That's the question you got to ask yourself.
Yeah.
And for me, there's no question that is whoop. There it is, because I'm sitting here right now with opportunities after 28 years of this record being out.
Yeah, amazing.
So I'm not tripping.
Yeah, man, good for you, and really cool that you embraced that. DC, we are getting there, man. I promise. Just a few more questions, man. I could talk to you all day. A little over 4 million views on YouTube. Of course, I'm talking about the Whoomp, There It Is video. Where was the video shot, and what can you tell me about the video?
Airplane, old airplane hangar in the middle of Atlanta. It's like they turned into like a soundstage, and they had like 4 different sets. And we shot the video, just moved from set to set, and it took about a day. And we shot it.
You know what the budget was?
I think like $60,000. Then that get charged back to you.
You know? Yeah, right. There you go.
All the buses, all the people you flew in, that get charged back to you. Record company's like, sure, we'll pay it. Yeah. Bring all your friends.
Yeah, and then we'll turn around and charge you. Yeah, man, it's pretty crazy. DC, with the video, how much creative input did you have?
Not as much as we wanted. They wanted to make it all Americana. They were real keen on keeping it clean, but I wanted to have dancing girls the whole nine. So it just didn't work like we wanted to. Plus, it just wasn't shot as crisp camera-wise as I would have liked. So therefore, MTV didn't really like the video. Only reason they played it is because it was a big record.
Gotcha. DC, the other half of Tag Team, your boy, Steve Rowland. Where is Steve today and what is he up to?
He's in Stone Mountain producing. I'll give you his information. You call him, because we do interviews. We do them separate because we both have different takes on how it happened, and it's kind of interesting because he has different takes. We're different in a lot of ways, right? But we're brothers, right? So it's like we both have different takes on things that have happened. So I'm sure his take on a lot of things would be interesting for you to hear. It's all the same, but to have somebody here, have somebody talk about something differently than I do. The reason I do these is because I'm blowing up my acting career. I want to, you know what I mean? And this is just part of it. And I love doing these podcasts, right? But he's more, you know, he just likes making the beats. He likes staying out of the shadow. He likes the shadows. And, you know, I love the show.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? I love the show. I love to be out there. I love to be in front of people. I love talking to everybody. I love everybody. And he's a little bit, and I'm not going to say secluded, but he's into his own thing. We have stayed with each other for a long time, and we've grown apart a little bit, but not in the way that you would think. Just in, you know, just as far as we're different. We see things differently as grown men. So you're going to have a different perspective when you're going to hear the same thing, but, you know, you're going to have a different perspective if you talk to him. So.
Yeah, it's cool. I'll have to get his information and have him on the podcast at some point in time. But DC, man, that's really cool that after all these years, man, you guys are still boys.
Yeah, man. That's forever. It has to be. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and I see other people that have been boys and they just can't keep it together. And I just don't, you know, and because I've seen that, I know what it takes. It's just relationships. You know, you gotta be strong-willed. You gotta be compromising. You gotta listen. It's just with any relationship, man. It has to work both ways a lot of ways. So, you know, when you gotta be willing to give a lot, you do. And if you're not willing to do that, then it's not gonna work. Period. But, I mean, we come from a community of friends, so we all are. We got like 6 friends, and we always will be friends. We boys, so it's just what we do. That's how you got to do it. I learned that from my parents, too, so I know the value of friendships.
Yeah, there you go, man. It's definitely hard to find, that's for sure. And another well-taught life lesson from your parents, DC. I like it. All right, DC, here we go, man. Last question. This is it, and then you are out of here. DC, Whoomp, There It Is. Was it more talent or was it more luck?
It was talent. I spit some good lyrics. Those are not easy lyrics, you know what I'm saying? Point blank, gin and juice I drank, getting bent and bent as I puff on dank. Point blank, and the juice I drink and bent and bent as a puff on deck. Like, people sing that and don't even know what that is, right?
Yep, no clue.
They're like, okay, you know, rock the mic. Uh-oh, I crave skin. Well, what skin? You know what skin is. Rock the mic. Uh-oh, I crave skin. You know, rip shit. Rip this mic. Find a honey dip to dip it in. Slam dunk it, stick it, flip it, and ride that B-O-O-T-Y, oh my. Ooh, that's it, come on, come on, whoop, there it is, I'm done. Rip, find a honey dip to dip it in, slam dunk it, stick it, flip it, and ride that B-O-O-T-Y, oh my. Ooh, that's it, come on, come on, whoop, there it is, I'm done. That ain't no just popcorn lyrics, them is lyrics. W-H-O-O-M-P as I flow, to the fly shit from the school of old, hardcore, kick the folklore wreck. 3, 2, 1, mic check. Mad skill flow ill on the mesh of steel. That's the grill of the microphone I just killed. Party people with your party tag team is through. Well, there it is. Thought you knew. W-H-O-O-M-P as I flow to the fly from the school of old. Hardcore, keep the folklore wreck. 3, 2, 1, mic check. Mad skill flow ill on the mesh of steel. That's the grill of the microphone I just killed. Party people with your party tag team is through. Whoop, there it is. I thought you knew. I got lyrics like that all day. Right. I am a lyricist, you know, I'm a lyricist, but I never got a chance to really fully express that and bring that to the world. But now I get to, because I'm a better rapper now than I've ever been, because now I know how to structure songs properly. I can tell stories. I can tell a whole story so good in a song because I do it through comedy. Comedy is making jokes, is structuring and having a premise and then having punchlines. And then going back to the premise again, and then bringing up the punchlines, and then adding a tag to it, right? You can do that with songs. Now your songs are entertaining and funny and lyrically sound. And because my voice is clear and my diction is proper, you understand every word I'm saying.
That's awesome, man. And the listeners actually just got to hear you pretty much sing half of Whoomp, There It Is. DC, sometimes this happens on the podcast, man, right? I said that was my last question. I apologize, man. I lied. Okay, here we go. This is the last question. Like I said, man, I could talk to you all day. This stuff is interesting. Very last question. So in that song, DC, Whoomp, There It Is, what comes first? Is it the beat or the lyrics?
The beat. Steve worked on the beat. And then I already kind of had the lyrics. Then I did mine. He wrote his. Then it just came together. And then it was like empty. So we just made some shit up. Woom Shakalaka was just some shit made up. Can You Dig It was just some stuff made up.
Okay, sure. Gotcha.
You see what I'm saying? Like all that stuff and all the bridges were just made up on the fly. And they stuck. All them little sayings, old school from the old fools from the old school, right? Tag team back again. You know, check it direct and let's begin. Party on, party people, let me hear some noise. DC's in the house. Because I said DC's in the house. Now everybody thinks I'm from Washington, D.C. Now D.C. is the biggest record in Washington, D.C. And we're up in Maryland doing shows.
That's good stuff, man. DC, the questions are done, man. They are over. But I want to give you the opportunity, pretty much like I give everybody else the opportunity who comes on the podcast for some final words. So, DC, any final words for the listeners listening around the world? Any advice that you can give maybe some of these kids out there who are looking to get involved in the music game, people who are looking to get involved in the entertainment industry, voiceover work, acting, any of that stuff, man? What do you got?
Stay on offense. Keep pushing. Don't stop. You know what I mean? You got to keep pressing. And if you don't know what to do, you better fucking figure it out. Because life's too short and you only get one shot at it. So why is you wasting time on what you used to have when you could have? You know what I mean? The only thing you got is tomorrow and what you do now and the decisions you make for right now. So keep pressing. Keep pushing. Keep that old stuff out of your mind because it'll cripple you. You know, and then we're in a pandemic, so people going through mental stress and stuff now. It's really important to keep your mind pressing. So that's my message to everybody. And another one, be able to admit when you're wrong. Because when you admit when you're wrong, the beauty is that you've learned something new and you'll never be wrong on that again. So you learn what not to do. You got to always think about it as learning what not to do. I embrace that wholeheartedly. It messes with my ego at times because you get older and you get set in your ways. When you get slapped down and know that you're wrong, you got to admit it and take it and then be happy about it because you've learned what not to do. So that's my message for everybody.
It's good stuff, bro. I like it.
You got it.
DC, that's it, man. You're officially done. Just want to really thank you for taking time out of your day to sit down and talk to me, man. We went pretty long, but you were very gracious to sit here and answer all my questions. So I do appreciate it. And best of luck to you the rest of the way, man, with everything you have going on, your acting, your comedy, everything with Tag Team, and everything else in life. Best of luck to you the rest of the way, man. And once again, greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, man. It has totally been my pleasure, dude. I just want to give a shout out to you, Cliff, and all your listeners. I appreciate y'all having me on, and just want y'all to be safe out there. Keep pushing. And remember, life is short, so stay on offense. Oh, yeah, and one more thing. Whoop! There it is. Had to leave y'all with one of those. Peace, y'all.
I just love that. It's so good. Hope everybody enjoyed my conversation with DC Glenn. Guys, we didn't get to plugs because we got talking and one thing led to another, but here you go. Let me throw some plugs DC's way. Instagram is DC Glenn ATL. Also on Instagram, Tag Team Whoop. Facebook is DC Glenn, and the website is tagteambackagain.com. Also, guys, I can't believe we didn't talk about it, but here you go. Make sure you check out DC and Steve Rowland and their new Geico commercial. You can check it out on YouTube, which right now has right around 13 million views. It is very funny. It is called Scoop. There it is. Make sure you check that out. Once again, very funny. Hope everybody enjoyed my conversation with DC Glenn. I will talk to you guys on the next episode, episode number 15. So make sure you check me out then. In the meantime, you guys stay well and be safe. I will talk to you on episode number 15 coming up soon. Peace.